Hello there, I'm Aaron Martell.
And I'm Lou Figaro.
And welcome to Ridiculous Rock Record Reviews, a podcast where we talk about and review a rock album of our choice. This episode, we're going to review Pearl Jam's 1991 debut album, 10. Lou, we've covered Pearl Jam before, but in case this is a new listener's first time with us, give like a quick overview of your Pearl Jam history and how you discovered 10.
Pearl Jam brings me to 91. 1992 art school. This was in the trusty Case Logic CD case that traveled back and forth along Route 22 from my house in Springfield, New Jersey, to the Ducray School in North Plainfield. The past 10 years were spent in spikes and leather, but it was all getting silly. Kid stuff. I was in art school. I found a new crowd, new sound. Jane's Addiction, Black Crows, Guns N' Roses had kind of pushed aside Faster Pussycat, Queensryche, Judas Priest, pushed them to the back. And now these new guys, along with Soundgarden, Smashing Pumpkins, Alice in Chains, taking way more space up in that 10 CD cube. Pearl Jam sounded like what would now be known as classic rock, but they were dirtier, less perfect. I heard that they were Mother Love Bone with a new singer, but at that time I had only heard of them. So it had no bearing on who this new guy was or the old guy who died. That discovery would come later. The most creative time in my life had this and a whole lot of other great music as the soundtrack. And when I hear this, it brings me back to that time.
Awesome. This is the third Pearl Jam album we've done on the podcast. We've covered Vitalogy and Yield. And as I've said, I came in with the band with this album, mostly because Sister Shannon said I needed to check it out because she knew I'd like it. Mm-hmm. She was hot onto the grunge thing right away, and she was right. I'd already heard Alive on MTV, and I liked that song, but it was like, what, almost a year before this thing broke? So I came to this record just before the rest of the country did, and then I got on the grunge train. And I remember I spent most of the summer of 92 listening to this and Soundgarden's Bad Motorfinger. Now I'll give you some basic facts about this record, coming to you from Wikipedia. 10 is the debut studio album by American rock band Pearl Jam, released on August 27th, 1991 on Epic Records. It was produced by Rick Parashar and Pearl Jam and was recorded from March 27th to April 26th, 1991, as well as in June 1991 at London Bridge Studio, Seattle, Washington, and Ridge Farm Studio, Surrey, England. It reached number 2 on the U.S. Billboard 200 chart and is certified 13 times platinum by the RIAA. And here's the band's lineup card. We've got Jeff Ament on bass guitar, Stone Gossard on rhythm guitar and slide guitar, Dave Crewson on drums and timpani, Mike McCready on lead guitar and acoustic electric guitar, and Eddie Vedder on vocals. There is one other musician, which we'll mention as we see fit. All right, let's dive into a track-by-track analysis of this album. The opening track is Once, written by Stone Gossard and Eddie Vedder. Lover on the side of the road, I got a bomb in my temple that is gonna explode. I got a 16 gauge buried under my clothes. I played once upon a time. I could control myself. Once upon a time. Lou, what do you think?
Well, it starts out with that weird stick bass intro. Later on, I found out it's a whole song called Master Slave. But then Stone's riff clangs out and the band stomps in. It's tension from the starting gate. You can hear it in the stifled groove in Ed's voice. Man, he sounds angry. Angry Ed is my favorite Ed. This is a part of the Mama Son trilogy that he wrote when they sent him a tape of instrumental songs that he put words to and sent them back. This was the second part. The events that happened before this, he sings about in the song Alive, but this is the character going mad, fucking prostitutes and killing them. And we'll get the rest of the story in a few minutes. The climbing groove lays a bedrock. Subtle change-ups, Dave Cruzan's earnest driving drums propel this song. Mike's solo is as many parts Stevie Ray Vaughan as it is Ace Frehley. It's composed in all the right places and has a strong melody of its own. Dave's blap de blap de blap de blap de bug de boom brings you right back into the anarchy. There's so much going on, and I fucking love it. This is a great opener. I love this fucking tune.
The album opens with a snippet of that Master Slave hidden track that comes at the end of the record, and then, like you said, it blasts off with a punch-your-face rocker built on Stone Gossard's riffs and the insistent rhythm from Jeff Ament on bass and Dave Cruzan on drums. Mike McCready supplies the classic rock wah-wah leads, and of course, the world gets introduced to the vocals of one Eddie Vedder, and he's really growling them out on this track. I dig the ascending progression of the chorus, and I read that the lyrics are about a man who goes nuts and becomes a serial killer, and that the song is that middle part of a three-song trilogy referred to as Mama San. I don't know, but as soon as he sings Backstreet Lover on the side of the road, I got a bomb in my temple that's gonna explode. I got a 16-gauge buried under my clothes. I'm like, hey, you sold me, Ed. You got me. Okay, Pearl Jam, I'm interested. Let's see what else you got. The next track is Even Flow, written by Stone Gossard and Eddie Vedder. How about this, Lou?
And like a punch in the face, we're inside another one. Iconic riff. From day one, this was one of the favorites. This has a swing to it that few songs have. Fucking banger. Again, the urgency in the lyrics are matched by the music. Oh, yeah. Even Flow. Can you imagine Cher doing this song?
Even Flow. I kind of can.
Everybody talks about the homeless thing. It's about a homeless guy caught up in the system, but he's insane and he's got no idea why and what's really happening. Stone's slinky groove draws you into a trance as Mike fucking kills it voodoo child style by the way of Texas Flood. All the while, Gossard, Ament, Cruzan are locked at the forehead behind him, with Ed babbling off in the corner with a razor blade and sleeve rolled up. Earburn aside, I still love this tune. Live, Matt Cameron, their current drummer, speeds it up big time. But the song is the time for their drummer to shine, whoever it may be to shine. In this case, it's Dave Cruzan on the album, who wound up in Candlebox after leaving these guys before the first tour. They're known for their unique set list, but even now, there's a 50-50 shot you're going to get Even Flow. There's an even better version of this song with Dave Abbruzzese playing drums that they used for the video. Swings even harder, if you can imagine. They released it as a B-side on Lost Dogs. Seek it out if you can.
Another super memorable Gossard riff in D tuning is complemented by McCready playing in standard tuning and doing his best piss poor Stevie Ray Vaughan impression, his words. Love the sliding and burps and Ament's fretless bass and the whammy bar on McCready's guitar in the chorus. McCready's leaning hard on that wah-wah pedal for the solo and almost overdoes it, but I still dig it. And Vedder's vocals on this track have been the subject of ridicule for a long time. And I admit, I didn't understand what the fuck he was singing at first. A feed, baby, he'll do your little medals and a danger. Oh, yeah. But you're still paying attention to him, aren't you? And that chorus is going to grab your ear and spooge on it, isn't it? And the lyrics are about a homeless dude with butterfly thoughts, but he don't know, and you don't either. But this is one of PJ's big tunes from this record, and it was the second single that reached number 3 on the U.S. Billboard Mainstream Rock Tracks chart. The following track is Alive, written by Stone Gossard and Eddie Vedder. You like this one, Lou?
Yeah, I do. That other now iconic riff. This one comes close to ear burn for me, but then I let the song play and remember how fucking powerful of a tune it is. This is the first part of that Mama Son trilogy I brought up earlier. For those late to the party, I'll bring you up to speed. Ed was working overnights at a gas station in San Diego while roadieing on the side while playing in a band called Bad Radio. Through the music scene, he met Jack Irons, who was Red Hot Chili Peppers' drummer at the time, and they became friends. Jack gave Ed a tape of his friends Stone and Jeff from a band called Mother Love Bone, who, on the verge of commercial success, lost their singer, Andy Wood, to a heroin overdose. They were starting a new band. That tape had 3 instrumental songs on it. It might have been 5, but it had these 3, which Ed wrote a mini opera to, and they became Alive, Once, and Footsteps. So here's the story. He talked about it in a Rolling Stone article. Alive was the first in a trilogy, a tale of a mother and father, and the father dies. The son, who looks just like the father, he reminds her of her true love, who she's lost forever. She's confused by all these stirrings she's got, and she wants him. The son is oblivious to all of this, and he doesn't know what the fuck is going on. He's still growing up, dealing with the death of his dad. All he knows is he's still alive. And here comes the mother, who tries to seduce him, and it fucks him up. He blocks the whole thing except how she looked at him. He doesn't know how to deal with it, so he starts going out and killing prostitutes. That brings us to the next song in the trilogy that we already talked about, Once. After becoming a serial killer and getting caught and thrown in prison, in Footsteps, an outtake from these sessions and a B-side, he gets executed, and it goes into hearing of the footsteps of his jailer coming to bring him to execution. This guy must be a riot at parties. Here's the kicker. Eddie Vedder's real father was hidden from him as early in his life, and he was made to believe his whole life that his stepfather was his real dad. His bio dad was his family friend. It wasn't revealed to him that this guy he knew was his real father until after the guy died. Sorry you didn't see him, but I'm glad we talked. This is deep shit, man. He took the tortured rock star route. I'm glad he took the tortured rock star route instead of the serial killer path in the real life, you know, in his own real life choose your adventure story. Actually, I've got a friend with a very convincing argument that Eddie Vedder is actually a serial killer, slowly eliminating his competition in the grunge singer territory like he's the Highlander of grunge singers. Think about it. Andy Wood's death got him the gig. Then Kurt Cobain, Scott Weiland, Chris Cornell. There could be only one.
Lane Staley.
The band just bashes away while McCready gives us a solo that sounds familiar until you put your finger on it. It's the same solo as Ace Frehley's as She in Dressed to Kill, which in turn is the same solo as Robbie Krieger's in 5-1 of Waiting for the Sun. Rock and roll DNA. Yeah. This song is Gen X's answer to the Who's My Generation.
This is the song that started it all for all of us. And it came from a Gosser tune he wrote while he was still a mother love bone and was called Dollar Short. As soon as you hear that opening lick, you know what's coming and where it's going. And everybody plays their part in making this song come together. Cruisin' keeps it loose on the backbeat. Ament's bass slides are choice. And the beginning of McCready's lengthy solo comes from Ace Frehley by way of Robbie Krieger. And you remember it. You know you do. Lou just reminded you if you forgot. And here comes Eddie Vedder with that stammer in his voice. And lyrics that went way over the head of most people. This is part one of the Mama San trilogy, and Lou went into excruciating detail about all this stuff, so I am not going to. But the kid is still alive, severely fucked up, but who cares? When you're singing, I'm still alive, you know, with an arena full of Pearl Jam fans, is there something wrong, she said? I say, fuck no. This song still packs a punch, and I'm all about it. This was the first single from the album that reached number 16 on the Billboard of Mainstream Rock Tracks chart. The next track is Why Go, written by Jeff Ament and Eddie Vedder. Lou, your thoughts?
Yeah, here's one for getting a pretty ferocious mosh pit going. Where's Mike when you need him? Imagine a hungry young rock band in 92 in a sweaty club with 300 or 400 people all figuring out what all the shit is together. Wasn't thrash, wasn't glam, wasn't punk, but it fucking rocked hard. And when you were done, you were out of breath, wet and sweaty. So let's take a look at the subject, which was a girl institutionalized for smoking pot by her parents. She's been diagnosed by some stupid fuck, and mommy agrees. Why go home? Yeah, why indeed, Mr. Vedder? Why indeed? Great fucking track.
To me, this kind of sounds like in spirit, like a sped up Even Flow. Both tracks have a similar feel to them musically to me. This one was written by Ament, so it's bass heavy, but I also dig the guitar interplay in the verses too. This track emphasizes the production in which everything, the music, the drums, including the distinctive drum intro, and the vocals are awash in reverb. It's drowning in it. And the album's received a little criticism, well, more than a little criticism for it. But I don't know, it's what 10 sounds like to me. It never really distracted me, and it still doesn't. McCready's solo's busy and fits the faster tempo, and Vedder pours some seething rage into the vocals. And Lou told you what the lyrics are all about, so I'm not going to. But why go home, indeed? The end of the track directly segues into the following track. And that following track is Black, written by Stone Gossard and Eddie Vedder. What about this one, Lou?
Oh, man. I thought this was the saddest song I ever heard until I heard them do it live, and that brought me to actual tears. Ed's poetic imagery is masterclass-level songwriting about a bad breakup and him wanting her back no matter what, even if she becomes a star in someone else's sky. But really, this is Mike's showcase, Mike fucking McCready, and the solo has a life of its own. But it mimics the emotional despair that the singer feels, weeping openly, dropping note for note, splashing it to the ground, sobbing uncontrollably, then settling, almost sighing, breathing, and then resolving itself to the misery that it's brought on itself. Absolutely brilliant. My eyes are welling up. Who's chopping onions in here? An amazing version of this is on Live on Two Legs, their live release from the 98 tour. Another phenomenal version is on the Let's Play 2 soundtrack, their concert film from Wrigley Field. I think it's 2017. Beautiful song.
Originally known as the E-Ballad that Gossard wrote and got circulated as part of that Stone Gossard Demos 91 tape and found its way into Eddie Vedder's hands, it's a slow rolling ballad with clean guitars in the verses and heavier chords in the choruses. There are important piano and Hammond organ contributions from producer Rick Parashar that keep bringing the do-do-do-do-do-do-do motif that plays heavily into the song's climax. But this track is where Vedder puts on a clinic and stakes his claim as one of the great grunge lyricists and vocalists. His voice drips with emotion as he relates the heartbreak of a love lost that's tearing him up inside. And by the time he gets to that phrase, "I know someday you'll have a beautiful life. I know you'll be a star in somebody else's sky, but why can it be? Why can't it be mine?" And if you don't feel that deep in your bones, you've never been in love and you're fucking heartless. McCready reaches for the sky on his crying solo on the outro as the vocals sound like hooting owls. Exactly. And this is one of the great Pearl Jam songs ever. Huge fan favorite, never a single, though the record company wanted it to be, but it was apparently too personal, according to the band. But radio stations played it anyway, because I heard it, and it did reach number 3 on the Billboard Mainstream Rock Tracks chart.
Listen to that Live on Two Legs version. You won't be disappointed.
The next track is Jeremy, written by Jeff Ament and Eddie Vedder. Lou, bring it.
That opening bass riff is cemented into the rock pantheon of all time. This is a song that has been overplayed to the point of violent takeover, and I'm still not sick of it. The layers of guitar weave and interplay with each other, adding groove and flourishes. Ed's voice rides on top with earnest conviction. The tale of Jeremy, the kid who shot himself in front of his class after enduring being bullied to the point of no return. Ed gave some oddly specific accounts. You can only wonder if he used some of his own experience to flesh out some of this song. Wouldn't it be wild if Jeremy didn't shoot himself and he'd grow up to be a motivational speaker touring the country? Jeremy spoken today. The underlying groove is what's king here, King Jeremy. And Jeff Ament has a lot to do with it. The soft bounce that the song has kind of oscillates into something huge by the end, and I get caught up in it every time. A lot of the diehard fans don't like this song when it comes up in concert, but I fucking relish every minute of it, especially live. These guys can make the building bounce under your feet. It's an incredible experience. Maybe I'm just spoiled because I've seen them at the Garden so many times, but this is just a fucking awesome tune to wrap up an absolutely perfect album side.
The music was written by Ament on an acoustic guitar, and as this thing builds, it gets denser and denser with 12-string bass, McCready on acoustic electric guitar, Gossard's rhythm guitar run through a Leslie speaker, and the grunge trick with quiet verses and heavier pre-choruses and choruses. Towards the end of the track, a cello played by Walter Gray is added to the dramatics on the outro. And once more, Vedder delivers big time on the vocals with the emotional intensity that will become his calling card, with plenty of memorable hoo-hoos and... Whoa! lyrics are inspired by a true story and are about a neglected and disturbed high school student who ends up shooting himself in front of his class. It's told from the point of view of a peer of Jeremy, and he describes the warning signs he saw in the kid as he grew up that led to that fateful day, you know, biting the recess teacher's tit and shit. King Jeremy the Wicked ruled his world. The lyrics are brilliant, though I didn't understand what ultimately happened. The lyrics don't really paint the clear picture of what actually occurred in that classroom. And the provocative music video didn't help at the time. It's a great video. But I thought that Jeremy shot his classmates. But it turns out that there was an unedited video in which the kid put the gun barrel in his mouth. You could see him do that. But MTV, of course, forced him to edit it.
Which caused an actually a worse idea in your head, if you think of.
Yeah. So for a couple of decades, I thought that Jeremy shot up his class.
Yeah, he shot up the class. Me too.
That's what I thought. I dig how it slows down all janky as it ends. It's a really cool ending to a song. How many times have I said that in this podcast? Hardly ever. And this is another popular tune from this band, as well as the third single that reached number 5 on the Billboard Mainstream Rock Tracks chart. I'm amazed that there's a segment of fans that don't like this. What the fuck?
And here's just another deep cut is one of their holiday singles that they send out to the 10 Club, at what they used to do it every year. They sent it one year. They sent a 10-inch, and on one side was a song called New Jeremy or No Jeremy is how they labeled it. Anyway, this song is a slower redesigned Jeremy, and it's something to seek out. Seek it out on YouTube. I'm pretty sure it's there.
The following track is Oceans, written by Stone Gossard, Jeff Ament, and Eddie Vedder.
You don't have to stray the oceans away. Waves roll in my thoughts. Hold tight the rain. The sea will rise. Please stand by.
Lou, let's have it.
Well, the way I'm used to it, this is it's from the CD, so you're not actually getting up and flipping over the album. So it's coming from the end of Jeremy right into this. And this is what puts the brakes on after the emotional tsunami. That's Jeremy. And it makes me feel like my boots are stuck knee deep in the mud. It adds a floaty quality to it and gives you a feeling of floating on an ocean waiting for the wave to take you back to shore where his love is waiting for him while he surfs. The metaphors for love and surf and Ed's devotion to his true loves, one and the same, and his lady in the sea. This is where the record kind of stumbles for me, but it is no way a detriment. This is... like even Muhammad Ali needed to step back and rope-a-dope while he gathered his strength. And they all can't be rockers. Even the drummer needs to take a breather every once in a while.
Ed Vedder has a thing for water. It shows up repeatedly in his work, and he often uses it to describe the flowing and shifting properties of love like he does here. He was a surfer. The music is gently strumming guitars, sliding fretless bass, and a drum beat played by Crewson on timpani that gives it a deeper vibe. And Oceans are motherfucking deep, son. I really like, once again, Vedder's ooh vocals. How's it go?
Ooh, ooh.
I love that. I love that.
And there's like four more of them going, oh, in the background, like way back.
Yeah. And I love that about this track. And this track kind of vaguely reminds me of The Ocean by the Velvet Underground, though it is not the same song. It just kind of shares that mellow vibe, and it also has timpani in it. A lot of people shit on this song, and Lou even kind of like took it back, you know, took a step back from it. But I've always dug it, and apparently it was the fourth single released internationally, but I never heard it on the radio.
It's got a pretty good video, too. Very surf-related.
The next track is Porch, written by Eddie Vedder.
All the
Lou, hit me.
They're famous for closing with this, closing the show, and it's a fucking barn burner. Ed's breaking up with his girlfriend or whoever, but he's not having a good time with it. She left without even a message, and he hoped he'd hear her voice one last time. Then he starts bitching about the shrinking middle class calling you to arms to leave the porch and speak up. Meanwhile, he wants his girlfriend back. He misses her. Okay, I don't know what the fuck he's talking about with this fucking song, but it kicks some serious fucking ass. It culminates into a jam at the end that brings the house down for the big finish. It's been known to cause Mike McCready to appallingly smash fucking expensive vintage Telecasters and Stratocasters into high-powered Marshall stacks and stage floorboards until they're just worthless piles of splinters. But it's a great friggin' tune.
Punk PJ, courtesy of Eddie Vedder. Yep, the guitars are raucous, the drums go fast, and then we even get a slowed-up breakdown section with some noodly soloing that's just there. The lyrics are about a relationship that's over, which needed to happen apparently. I mean, what the fuck? It was a daily minefield. But shit's hard, you know? This is the one track I could take or leave off this album, so that makes this
Aaron's Stinky Stinker.
Wow. You haven't seen them live then.
Good point. The following track is Garden, written by Stone Gosser, Jeff Ament, and Eddie Vedder. Lou, what do you say?
Well, they slam the brakes again on this, but somehow it's different. The cyclic fingerpick pattern that Stone does with the soft rimshot, soft jazz drumming lulls you into a warm opiate bliss. Ed's harmonizing with himself, facing death without buying into the consolation provided by faith in a religion that promotes an afterlife. The Garden of Stone is a cemetery. It's ominously heavy, and the theme matches the music perfectly. This is way better experienced in headphones. Try to pick apart all the layers at the end. Great song.
Quiet, clean guitar arpeggios, atmospheric reverbed vocals, rim shots. This thing comes into focus with the heavier I Will Walk chorus. This is about setting a mysterious dark tone, and I love the descending progression in the bridge. It also gives McCready a chance to solo, and he makes some interesting long-sustained note choices, even with a kill switch. He doesn't rip through it until the end, where he does toss in a bit of flash. I interpret the lyrics as a man who's defiantly facing down death. He doesn't care about faith. He doesn't care if you pray for him. He's going out on his own terms. It's haunting and it works. I dig. The penultimate track is Deep, written by Stone Gossard, Jeff Ament, and Eddie Vedder. Lou, let's have it.
Yeah, they fling you right into the deep end of the pool with this one. And you sink pretty fast. It's so fucking heavy. Deals with the shitty aspects of our lives and the urge to cope or escape in very unhealthy ways. Three characters. A drug addict pondering his life as he takes the needle. Thinks about his relationship with society and feels worthless. So he might as well sink that needle in. You got another guy who feels like he's superior to everybody. Maybe a little religious superiority, looking down on everybody else, knowing he's closer to God than any of them. And that suburban girl who thinks she's more street than she really is, and she's tougher than she really is, winds up in over her head some dude. Then it's too late. She's in too deep. Can't touch the bottom. This grows legs in concert, too. It's a great tune. Pretty deep, man.
Over a syncopated Dave Crewson beat, the guitarists wheel out some wah-wah-drenched interplaying licks that dance with each other while Vetter stammers the verse vocals and yowls out the chorus vocals. And to me, it's Pearl Jam's version of a noise rocker. Lou's got you covered on the lyrics. Your feet ain't ever going to touch the bottom on this one, but he's got a great view when he's that high. Not a favorite track for me, but I don't hate it. I dig. I would never turn it off. And that brings us to the final track, Release, written by Stone Gossard, Jeff Ament, Dave Crewson, Mike McCready, and Eddie Vedder. About this last one, Lou.
Ironically, they open shows with this. A slow burner. Maybe to get everybody in their seats without a stampede. As they matured with experience, they'd become very sensitive to the impact on crowds and how dangerous they can become when a mob mentality takes over. A few years later, they'd be playing a festival in Roskilde, Denmark, that would take the lives of 9 fans in a crush near the front of the stage. But it's become like a church when they play it. Hell, when they open with anything, sometimes, Of the Girl, Love Boat Captain, this song, Pendulum, it's always a slow simmer to boil, and it's always powerful as hell before they unleash. Release is deeply personal. It's reflecting Ed's experience dealing with his father's absence in his life. The lyrics convey a sense of longing to connect with a guy who's no longer there. I am myself like you somehow. Like it's inevitable that his father's influence on him, despite the fact that they're never met. He's surrendering, riding the wave where it takes him. He's letting go of control. I'll hold the pain. Release me. He's asking his father to reach out to him from beyond the grave and give him closure. Release him. I'm among the many that can identify with the sentiment and can easily attach meaning to many of these songs and internalize his anguish. This band touches a nerve with me and many, many others in what's been stupidly referred to as the Jamily. Pearl Jam fans, they're like no others. It's a feeling of community. It's like church, all coming for that spiritual connection to this band. I can't describe it, but everyone I bring to a Pearl Jam show tells me the same thing. They tell me that they get what I was talking about when I described this to them. The entire crowd sings in unison back to this band. It's like waves of adoration is just reflected back at this band, and they feed on it. The power exchange between band and crowd is palpable. It's like being at a revival at a mega church, hands in the air and feel the spirit through you. It's weird, but it's what it is. It's quite powerful when all the lights come on and they stop playing and everybody's still singing. I cannot understate the cathartic power of singing this at full volume from whatever seat you're standing in front of at the show, or in the shower, or in the car, or perhaps at the supermarket or library with your earbuds in. Although if you're in the car, I'd roll up the window so people don't think that you're a Broadway actor that was abducted and stuffed into your trunk. Fucking powerful song. Perfect ending to a very important, essential album. I love this fucking record.
So we close 10 on a gorgeously spread out ballad with lightly distorted and clean guitar arpeggios and a gentle up and down bass line until Vetter projects out Release Me and the wah-wah guitars return, turning up the volume and emotional intensity without forcing the tune to go faster. Vetter seems to be singing to his departed father, feeling a connection though he never really knew the guy, hoping that somehow by opening himself up, his pain and hurt can somehow be let go, released as it were. Love this track. It's painfully pretty, and it leads to the extended version of the master-slave instrumental hidden track that opened the album and now rides the record to a close. Now that the track-by-track is over, we'll give our final thoughts and album ratings. For you new listeners, the rating is a 0 to 5 system, with 5 being a favorite album of ours, all the way down to a 0, which fucking spoke in class today. Lou, give us your final thoughts on 10.
Pearl Jam was exactly what I needed when I needed them. I was getting tired of the cartoonish idiocracy that was heavy rock and what it became towards the end of the 80s. There were these clones of clones, and everyone was either trying to become Aerosmith or be Guns N' Roses. Alice in Chains, Facelift, and Soundgarden's Louder Than Love were the first to hit the CD cube. Then this song, Alive, started getting played on this station called WSOU, the college station I was locked in on. And I picked it up, and it didn't come out of my player for, I'd say, a good 6 months. It was on repeat while I worked for most of my art school projects. And when it came time to play in the cover band I was in, I insisted on doing Jeremy and Alive. And even after a few hundred hours of rehearsing and playing those songs, I'm still knocked sick of them. A lot more than I could say for the AC/DC, Hendrix, Stone Temple Pilots, and Aerosmith tunes that we learned that I can't even listen to now. This record turned me on to so much more than Pearl Jam. Through this album, I learned of Temple of the Dog, Mad Season, and Mother Love Bone. All three of those albums are essential listening to. Say what you will about Eddie Vedder, outspoken about issues like a woman's right to her own body, disdain for the right-wing political ideologies, countries starting at unjust wars for corporate gain, and conglomerations who monopolize the ticketing industry. But he joined the club of socially conscious douchebags like Bono, Morrissey, and Sting. But here, he's still a scared, hungry kid who's got his one shot at fame with spaghetti on his mom's sweater. They swung for the bleachers and, to everyone's surprise, got a home run, quickly realized that fame was not what it was cracked up to be, and would spend their next few records digging their heels into the dirt, trying to put the brakes on what they perceived as a runaway train to preserve their social and artistic integrity. It seriously fucked with these guys' heads, and in turn, they fucked with ours. Still, I give 10 a solid 5, and is absolutely in the top Desert Island discs for me. As a footnote, after this record, produced by Temple of the Dog producer Rick Parashar, who, as with the current production trends, drenched it in reverb, buried the vocals somewhat. They then developed a long relationship with Brendan O'Brien, the producer, over the course of the next several records, and his grounded, warmer, live-in-the-room approach became integral to their sound after this album. The band asked them to do a remix, and the 10 redo is a more in-your-face rock record than the grunge classic that this was when it was first released in 92. With far less reverb, punchier mix, and the drums stand out a lot more. The guitars have more bite, and the vocals are right out in front. This version has become my favorite over the original.
Pearl Jam was once called Mookie Blaylock, after the basketball player of the same name, and they titled their first album after the real Mookie's jersey number. Stone Gossard and Jeff Ament had been bandmates in legendary Seattle proto-grunge bands Green River and Mother Love Bone, and Mike McCready came from his previous group, Shadow, which had broken up. They recorded 5 demos that were circulated as Stone Gossard Demos 91 that made its way to Eddie Vedder, who wrote lyrics and recorded vocals for 3 tracks and sent them back, which impressed the others enough to bring Vedder in for an audition. Vedder flew to Seattle and brought lyrics with him to another track from the demo, which would end up being called Black, and rehearsed with the band for a week, writing 11 songs and subsequently getting hired as the vocalist. The band got signed to Epic Records and changed its name to Pearl Jam to avoid any legalities with Mookie Blaylock. The group entered the studio with producer Rick Parashar and worked quickly. Much of the material was already written from old Mother Love Bone songs with reworked lyrics, and they knocked out most of the record in a month. Drummer Dave Crewson left the band after the sessions to enter rehab. The album cover was designed by Lisa Sparagano and Risa Zajcek. I probably butchered those pronunciations. You know the drill. And it's a photo taken by Lance Mercer of the band standing together with one arm raised each, their hands meeting in the air as a sort of one for all for one expression in front of a wood carving of the band's name against a pink background. When the album was released, it sold slowly and received mixed critical reviews. But in the wake of Nirvana's Nevermind and the Seattle scene blowing up, it caught fire nearly a year after it was released and ended up surpassing Nevermind in sales, suddenly making Pearl Jam one of the biggest bands in the world and their struggles with fame that Lou detailed. This has been and probably always will be my favorite Pearl Jam album. It's nominally a grunge album, but it really has more in common with classic rock sonically. The guitars are textured with heavy wah-wah, and the solos evoke your Hendrix, Vaughn, and Fraley influences. It's Eddie Vedder's voice and unconventional lyrics that mark this as a grunge record. Unfortunately, as far as I'm concerned, it also was influential in kickstarting the 90s alternative rock explosion that I personally struggled mightily with. But none of those cookie-cutter bands equaled what Pearl Jam did here, in my opinion. Now, in retrospect, this has been critically praised as a landmark album. But us fans already knew that. Those bozos didn't need to tell us. I give 10 a 4.5. And yeah, the story of Pearl Jam continues. They still put out records and rock arenas and stadiums around the world. But for me, they got it just right on their first time out. And that's going to do it for this episode. You can find this podcast on all the podcasting platforms wherever you listen to them. If you like what you hear, please subscribe or follow the podcast and leave us a review. If you'd like to contact us directly, we can be reached at ridiculousrockrecords@gmail.com or also on the Ridiculous Rock Record Reviews Facebook page, where there's a link to hear each podcast. We're also on Twitter at R4PodcastAaron and Instagram under R4Podcaster. Feel free to leave all of your feedback, comments, reviews, and or suggestions at any of those places I just described. We'd love to hear from you. So for the R4 Podcast, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Lou.
See ya!
You think I got my eyes closed, but I'm looking at you the whole fucking time.
There can be only one!
Middle part of the three-song trilogy referred to as Mama-san? I think it's called Mama-san.
Mama-san, yeah. Mama-san.
Yes.
Yeah. Hold on. I can't read my notes.
I can't read my notes.
Oh, sorry.